you should be able to push rents. There's a stat I like to point to. In the last 24 years, compounded cost growth for new construction up 3.7% compounded over 24 years' time. That same time frame for multifamily rents, compounded rent growth only 3.2%. Even though we've had 70% rent growth the last 10 years, there was lots of periods where you didn't get rent growth because of things that were happening in the marketplace. But in general, long-term compounded rent growth is only 3.2%. So rents have not kept up with the reality of what it costs to produce new product.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping real estate and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Tim Wallen. Tim is CEO and principal of MLG Commercial, that focuses their portfolio on Midwestern industrial, multifamily, and office assets. On the podcast, we discuss the power of cost segregation, tax strategies, the challenges of penciling workforce housing deals, and adapting deal strategy to disrupted markets. It's well worth a listen.
Tim, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Good to be here, Gordon.
So, why real estate?
Well, why real estate? Big question there. Big picture, real estate is a great diversification tool for investors away from the public marketplace. So we've got a very low correlation rate to the S&P 500. We tend to focus very heavily in multifamily. So multifamily has some exceptional income tax benefits as well. In my young days, I was an old Pricewaterhouse tax manager. So prior to joining MLG, I guess 35 years ago, I'm dating myself here. I did a lot of tax stuff for other real estate companies in my experience. So great after-tax results and great diversification from public markets.
So what are those tax results?
Well, it's kind of crazy. If you use all the tools available, you know, we have the benefit of having 12 CPAs on staff. I have over 900 employees. And, you know, there's some great tools that we use. The biggest thing that I think most real estate guys miss is they don't do cost segregation studies. That's the real juice that gives incredible after-tax benefits and results that we always encourage real estate folks and you know, to use that tool. It's a great tool.
Let me dig a little deeper into that. So when you mentioned cost segregation studies, how do you apply that in your practice?
So, you know, what we do when we buy a property within, you know, 30, 60, 90 days of closing, we go out and get an engineered study that analyzes all the elements of the property. So, for example, if you turn to your right, turn to your left, and you see that light socket, you know, on the wall, that light socket's got a different life than the wall itself. And so you bust apart your purchase price into the different asset classes, but you need an engineered study to do it right. So you get the right mathematics so you can support that position with IRS if they ever come look at what you did. So you need the engineered study so it's valid. And I wouldn't recommend doing it without a formal engineering study.
What do you find is the biggest cost segregation tool that you get benefit from?
Well, I mean, you know, to the extent that you move depreciation life from you got the real estate building, you know, multifamilies, you know, gives you a 28 depreciation life or 39 and a half years for a commercial. You can get down to 5 and 7 year or 15 year property. For example, a parking lot has a 20 year life versus the building itself be 28 or 39 years for commercial property. Or if you can get, you know, the more you can get in 5 and 7 year property, that gets you depreciating those items over 5 to 7 years versus over 28 or 39 years. So it's a huge impact on your after-tax cash flows. And you know, one other thing that a lot of investors miss in private real estate investing is the consistent ongoing investment is critical to creating all the maximum tax benefits. And there's some hidden things that, again, most real estate guys don't really fully understand. There's a lot of guys that want to do the, I'll call it the buy and hold strategy. Buy and hold strategy fails from an income tax perspective in many regards because as you go over time, you burn through your basis and you start paying money to the government that you wouldn't necessarily have to. But ironically, if you sell a property and you trigger passive capital gain income, the irony is that allows the use of passive ordinary losses. So if we give somebody $500,000 of passive cap gain income, and now they have $500,000 of passive ordinary losses sitting there that are unable to be used, they now can be used. And once that $500,000 of taxable income gets into your return, the ordinary piece can go against retirement income, interest income, anything that's taxed at the highest rates, and the cap gain piece goes at cap gain rates. And, you know, the first $500,000, actually today they came out $580,000 for married couples is taxed at only 15%. Well, this was 18.8 with the Obamacare tax. So there's some real dynamic tax things you can do over a long period of time, but the art of capturing those benefits is consistent annual investment in private real estate over a long period of time.
So when you say that goes along with kind of your strategy generally, is that you're not a super long-term buy and hold firm. You typically like to deploy assets, maximize, and kind of move on.
Well, I'd say five, you know, just typically holding assets for anywhere between 3 and 10 years. But most assets are 5 to 8 years. But there's a bell curve, you know, around the bulk of the assets are held in that, you know, 5 and 8 year window. Some assets will spin out in 2 to 3 years and some assets will hold 10. It really depends on the speed of how we accomplish our plans on an asset, the market conditions, you know, overall.
And when we're talking about market conditions, I'm curious, multifamily seems like it's kind of in an interesting spot. What are you seeing generally in the market? And to give context to listeners, what regions of the country are you primarily invested in?
So we have a pretty broad geographic platform. Kind of one of the things that makes us unique, about half of our annual investments, we've been averaging about $1 billion a year in acquisitions. So we're doing a lot. And even through the cycle here where people have a hard time raising capital, we maintain that $1 billion a year type acquisition platform. But we're basically acquiring about 18 to 20 states. Basically stay away from the coasts, East Coast, West Coast, stay in Central America. And we just find better valuations in general overall. You know, what we're seeing in the market, I actually look at this and it's really an interesting time. If you go back, again, I've been doing this for 35 years with MLG and before that was with Pricewaterhouse, you know, advising real estate clients. But so I've been watching, I've been in this industry for almost 40 years now in total. And if you go back to this, it's a smaller version. Well, let me go broader space. We're in a market, we have excess supply versus demand. It's more supply deliveries than there's been demand to absorb. Now, I believe that to be a short-term condition. I believe that most of these markets will absorb. There's going to be exceptions where they've overbuilt the market and it's going to be very difficult to work through that, but and take a longer period of time. But most markets that overbuild, especially in the Sun Belt, they're going to grind through that product. And, you know, we're seeing new construction starts, you know, coming to a screeching halt. And the mathematics of new construction, cost of construction are way up, interest rates up, way up. And the combination of the two making the mathematics of new construction very difficult to put the shovel in the ground, very difficult to raise capital to do that. So I kind of equate this to a period somewhat similar to the early 90s. We came out of the Resolution Trust days. We had the savings loan crisis in the late 80s. You know, the market was way overbuilt because of all the tax laws. And when Reagan had all the tax laws, the market way overbuilt inventory because they were building stuff for income tax reasons, not for economic reasons. So the government's incentives created the policies that drove a lot of supply creation when the market really didn't need it. And so a lot of income tax strategies that drew excess supply. So then you had a nice period of 4 to 5 years from, you know, early 89 through two, maybe not 94, very little in the way of deliveries relative to long-term demand needs. What's called ballpark, you need about 400,000 units per year multifamily to meet general household formation numbers and growth. And you were seeing, you know, starts, annual starts in the 100 to 200,000 per year range for multiple years in a row. Similar scenario coming out of the Great Recession, 2008-09. From really, you know, late 2000, mid 2008 through about 2013, again, back down to that 100 to 200,000 kind of annual starts. You know, we're on our way down to that level, I think, again. You know, we're on the most recent first quarter, like 80,000 starts, which puts you on a pace of 300,000 annual starts, something like that. You know, we got as high as 600,000 annual starts, 600,000 in that range, back in, you know, we're really back in 21, 22 and delivering those in 23 and 24. There's some residual stuff being delivered now. But I think last quarter starts were down on the 60,000 units per range. Again, getting down about 240,000 annual pace. And I would not be surprised if that dips down to, you know, the 50, 40, 30,000 units being started in the quarter. So I do think we're coming out of that that delivery cycle, and it's going to flip back the other way. It's always really fun on the other side of the cycle when you start delivering product. It's very fun, you know, coming back out the other side.
So I know we're going to talk about supply, but I'm curious, diving into it, you said your strategy was primarily focused on the middle of the country. And I'm curious, why do you think you get better valuations in the middle of the country?
Well, I mean, you know, big picture in the middle of the country, we generally, now we do a lot in the Sun Belt. Okay. We have a big operations in Texas. We're the fourth largest property manager in Dallas, Texas. You know, we do a lot in the Sun Belt. But I would say in general, the market doesn't deliver as much supply versus demand. And the problem is that when you have a go-go market like a Dallas or a Phoenix or anything in the Florida markets, the yin and yang of supply and demand. So monster demand growth happening, right? All these companies moving from California to Texas because they don't want to pay income taxes and they want a better environment, lower cost environment for the employees. So you have this you know, significant movement of jobs and population, Sun Belt. And so the developers try to stay ahead of that. And sometimes they get too far ahead of it. And that's what happened in really 21, 22, starting a lot of stuff. It was also artificially impacted by artificially low interest rates that aren't sustainable. You know, the math got too easy for developers as far as putting the shovel in the ground because interest rates were so low. You know, and if you borrow money at 3.5%, then you could sell at a 4 cap and you're done. The math just looked wonderful. But all of a sudden today, you know, you're borrowing money and you're at 7.5 or 8% and your cap rate is up to 6% or 5.75 or 5.5. All of a sudden that math doesn't look so good. And so it's been a major shift, but the Midwest hasn't had that significant supply side. And so we're able to buy stuff in the Midwest today in the 5.5, 6 cap range. That's a reasonable cap rate valuation versus interest rates. We're still seeing, like in Dallas, you're still seeing like a high fours, low fives cap rate environment. So you effectively have negative leverage on the buy side right now with where the borrowing rates are on the debt side. No, that doesn't mean we won't buy there. I mean, and, you know, we're buying some soft NOIs right now in the Sun Belt. You know, occupancies are soft, concessions are up, and, you know, rents are flat. And so the NOIs are flat. You know, the communities got really aggressive on real estate tax bumps. So real estate taxes are up. Insurance rates ran through the roof. And so you got soft NOIs, and you're capitalizing those soft NOIs at, you know, certainly much more attractive cap rates than we've had recently. And I do think you're going to have a snapback in NOI in the Sun Belt, but it's going to take a couple of years to get there. You're going to need the supply deliveries to slow down dramatically and let the market absorb all that product that was delivered over the last 3 years.
So what kind of product in the Sun Belt are you seeing? Conversely, is there a certain type of asset class and within the multifamily space that's resilient? And is there a certain type of asset class within the Sun Belt multifamily that you think is more likely to head towards potential distress?
So, you know, I'd say pre-COVID, pre the whole inflation run, there was multiple strategies that worked really well. I mean, even taking workforce housing product, Class C, Class B product, doing the value add strategy worked very well. And frankly, there was a marketplace, you know, where the tenants could afford some higher rents for a value add improved unit. And certainly you still had the Class A and B stuff product as well. But what happened in this cycle, the workforce housing tenant got crushed. The rampant move in interest rates, the rampant speed of which interest rates moved and then inflation followed with that, really, really hurt the workforce housing tenant. Their salaries and compensation haven't kept up with inflation. So they've really been squeezed. So in the workforce housing tenant space, you're seeing people move in together. You're seeing people move back home or whatever because they can't afford stuff. And so you're seeing less demand for multifamily in that space. And you're seeing occupancy soften up. You're seeing concessions grow because the people can't afford stuff. You still have the lingering problem of evictions for people that are not paying. The court systems are still not back to normal, you know, pre-COVID normal as far as what it takes to have a tenant be evicted who's not paying their rent. So, you know, right now we're staying away from workforce housing. Any workforce housing we have in our portfolio, we're working up to a sale, you know, get polishing it up and looking to move it out and redeploy that capital into a newer product. You know, the institutional buyer is certainly taking a big pause in investing in multifamily. And now I think that, again, is going to change. But, you know, when interest rates dropped, I mean, when interest rates ran up, really hurt the bond market. And so a lot of institutional players, their bond portfolios got a big whack. And what happens is now there are whole asset allocation models off. And so they can't deploy new money into the stock market or in private real estate or private equity because they got to put that money into the bond market. And in fact, you know, we all heard about some large institutionals doing material redemptions out of a lot of the large institutional funds. And there was a lot of redemption requests that weren't even met because the institution guys were looking to move capital out of private real estate back into bond portfolios to get their asset allocation models worked out. So we are starting, you know, we use the term right now, you know, got to beat the herd. We got to beat the institutional herd coming back. You know, Blackstone recently bought AIR Communities, took the, you know, public REIT private. So there's no doubt that institutional money is going to come back. And, you know, they're probably getting closer to having their allocation models back in order. So we have not had, that's why we love to buy in the last 18 months. We have not had the institutional competition on the buy side for Class A assets that are well located. So we've been able to get some really interesting cap rate buys on Class A product in great locations. So we're very focused on 2000 and newer inventory in great locations. And really focusing on institutional grade product, as we believe when the market snap back and we get better NOI growth and better operational numbers because the market absorbs the excess supply, at that same time, we think the institutional money will be back in the market on the buy side, improve the cap rates on exit. So interesting time to be in the market.
So one of the things that we're definitely in the market for, and we've been growing not only our management portfolio, but also working with a number of investors to go and find industrial assets in Chicagoland, which has been generally both Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, has been relatively robust. And I know that your portfolio has assets that are in the industrial class. So I'm curious, where is it predominantly located? Is it very similar to the multifamily portfolio that you have? Or
We have about 5 million square feet of commercial assets, mainly almost all industrial. We have a little bit of retail in there. We have one office building. Mainly upper Midwest. You know, we're in Ohio, we're in Illinois, we're in Wisconsin, we're in Minnesota. So we're mainly in the upper Midwest and pursuing stuff like that. So we try to do portfolio buys as much as possible. But it's a hard asset class to buy.
It is.
You know, it just is just a lot of competition. Now, there's been less competition. Probably saw a solid 100 to 150 basis point movement in cap rates and industrial. So it's been good to be a buyer, but it's still hard. People, you know, a lot of that product that we want to buy, I like buying older stuff that's got lower rental rates. Very hard to replace that. And if they want to space, they got to pay for the newer product that might have rents that are, you know, 70% higher. So we like that existing industrial space, but a lot of it's owned by the local, you know, local community, local business, real estate community. So it's hard to get a hold of that. I don't like to play in the big institutional industrial space. Too much capital is there. It's too easy to slap up a new distribution building, new warehouse facility. Communities are very typically easy on the zoning, allowing you to slap up industrial buildings. So it's very easy to get caught in an excess supply situation. You know, for example, in southeastern Wisconsin, there's like 5 million square feet of vacant industrial product right now, because a lot of stuff is built up because, you know, we're effectively a northern Chicago market for a lot of folks that want to be just north of the border.
I mean, you drive around Pleasant Prairie or Kenosha and Racine. I've been certainly doing a number of deals and evaluating deals up there. And there's a lot of vacancy. I think one of the things that has always kind of struck me in particular is the extremely large, big square box model that we're starting to see, or at least have seen over the last maybe 10 years up there, where some of it is not very divisible. I'm curious, when you're talking about Class B and C industrial that you're diving into, what's the kind of property that you're most interested in?
You know, we try to, ideally, we buy an older flexed up that's got minimal office. They tend to get too much office in them. So hopefully not too much office, because you can't rebuild that stuff. It's so expensive to rebuild it. And the demand's there for that product. And, you know, we bought a enlarged portfolio in Ohio. You know, rental rates for all in the, you know, $3.50 to $4 foot range. And, you know, you move your rents out 50 cents or 75 cents or 80 cents a foot, there's nowhere they can go, you know, and you just got to have the balls to hold firm on that rate. And generally you can get it with no TI.
And so when we're talking about that, and try to avoid TI, I definitely want to get back to that point, but I'm curious, have you primarily found your multi-tenant industrial deals and kind of that small Class B, you primarily buying portfolios, or are you trying to buy one-off properties?
You know, we've mainly focused on portfolios, but, you know, we have done some smaller, you know, one-off stuff. You know, we certainly will look at stuff and we'll, if especially if we have other product in the area. So if we have a portfolio in a market and then we buy, you know, a couple smaller buildings, or smaller portfolios, we can kind of roll them together and operate them together, you know, just from a portfolio perspective.
And when you're trying to go and reduce TI and reduce TI dollars, I know that's something that we've been working tenaciously at in our portfolio, because dollars and cents and TI really matters, even though you can amortize it over a 5-year span or a 7-year span or a 10-year span if you get really lucky. I'm curious, where do you find that TI dollars skyrocket the most when you're doing deals?
So really more in the context of the scale of, okay, yeah, at what point to say, I'm just not going to invest this kind of money in this space. You know, then it becomes, you know, through there, it becomes a credit decision. You know, if the more you got to invest in a space for a particular tenant, the more term you're going to want out of them and the better credit you're going to want from that tenant. So it becomes much more of a banking decision as the dollars go up. I'm not afraid of spending the money if we have the credit to back up that request, you know, overall. So to me, it's more once you get over, you know, market rate, you know, if we're not doing modest wall movement, modest interim, you know, stuff, and we're doing polish up, paint, some flooring, that's fine. You know, you start going into significant investment, there better be some credit there and there better be some turn there to justify it.
So in terms of that, one of the biggest things that we see in the market is increasingly there's flex uses coming into the industrial park. And I know that there's going to be people listening to this podcast from LA and New York and Miami that flex is a different word for them sometimes. But in terms of that, we see flex as being uses that aren't traditionally industrial uses often coming in. And that's been a real difficult point for some of our owners. I'm curious how you perceive not atypical industrial uses in the portfolio.
For example, like a church, right?
Like a church or an exercise place, a gym, a children's bouncy house. Many of these we're starting to see in our industrial parks, a brewery. And so how do you guys pursue that in deals? That's something that we have vastly different takes on this podcast.
So in general, when we're buying industrial, we try to buy vacancy as much as possible. I like buying, like we bought a big industrial deal up in Minneapolis about a year and a half ago. It was 17% occupied, but now we're up to 7%. So I like buying vacancy. And so I say that in the context, if some of your space is that less industrial type use, it's okay. You can't get too nuts and have too much of it because it'll impact your cap rate on the exit. So you got to watch this, the magnitude of how much space it takes within your center, or you better be willing to hold it longer. We have a couple shopping centers and, you know, some of the sort of fitness craze hit the shopping center world. In general, it gets hard to sell because the cap rates that people want to pay with that aren't that great. So then you look at your cash on cash yield holding and go, I'm better off holding a sucker than selling it for that cap rate. I'd say a lot of the retail centers that we have fitness that we move fitness into, we're finding we're just holding longer because the cap, you know, also we're getting into cash on cash yields that are 12-13% or something. You start working your way up and you go, well, why would I sell that for an 8.5 or 9 cap? You know, why not ride it? And I know their numbers are good. I know their membership numbers are good. And the buying market's not acknowledging that. And so we'll take the risk and hold it, you know? So it you get those non-conventional uses and it has impact on cap rates. I think if you do too much of it, you have to be ready to hold.
I know there's a building that we have owned for a while and still own, and it had a dog, definitely focused veterinary clinic, a vape shop, like all the worst uses all in one building. And the building has been incredibly profitable for us. And I know we had an individual or two reach out to try to buy it as for a steal. And we're like, no, it's printing cash. Like that's not the case. We're not going to sell it to you for cents on the dollar. In terms of that, when you're looking to buy a vacancy, are you buying it primarily for cents on the dollar? Is that where you see the value? Are you buying vacancy because it's not a space that's screwed up already? That's one of the things that I know that
I would say we're not afraid of having to reconfigure space, but the price needs to reflect the reality of having to reconfigure space, right? So there's no doubt it's a value play, and we're looking to pay a price per square foot that's significantly below what we can sell it for. And there's got to be enough delta for that negative carry during lease up and any anticipated TI costs, and then leave a spread for when we sell it. I say in general, we do with all commercial assets for the most part, is we buy stuff. We have to have a strategy how we're going to grow our NOI. And once we've achieved that, we tend to sell. We tend not to hold. Whereas industrial, our typical hold might be 2 to 5 years for industrial, where multifamily, we're more 6 to 8. Certainly with retail, retail is a must sell upon fixing. And an office is an absolute must sell after you steal it on the buy side. If you don't pay hardly anything for office, you can't make the numbers work or take the risk.
In terms of that, why do you see it as a 2 to 5 year ideal for industrial versus multifamily, which is a little longer?
Well, if you play in this in the flex space, you got to still realize you have a product that can have some pretty material TIs. And in general, I'd say the marketplace doesn't properly capitalize that business risk. And so we think you're better off to exit, sell it, take the capital and go buy something else versus holding it and taking the risk of the turn and another batch of TIs on the turn. Now there are exceptions to that. We have an evergreen fund structure that does have a fair amount of industrial in it. And so in the right locations for the right product, sometimes industrial space, it's already cut up, right? All the expense of cutting it up is there. You don't, you're not really expecting to undo the way it's been cut up, and it's got a bunch of 3,000 and 5,000 and 10,000 square bays, and you're just going to lease it that way like an apartment complex. You're not going to move walls. You might do some internal walls a little bit, but you're not going nuts on a redo. You're not going to blow out, you know, 3,000 to 10,000 square foot bays to create a, you know, 25,000 square foot bay. You made that capital investment for the smaller bay. Why would you, and there's enough demand for those bays and such limited supply of those bays, why would you blow them up? So there are exceptions to, you know, that. But, you know, also when you're at the bigger stuff and all of a sudden you got a mix of 30, 40, 60, you know, 15, you got a variety of sizes in there. That's where the user's all sort of telling you, well, no, I don't want your 60,000 square foot base. I want 30 of them, or I want 40 of that. And you know, so, and then, you know, so then, you know, whatever. So it's a little more expensive on that. So our philosophy is lease it up, sell it. If you think there's TI risk, if you don't have as much TI risk, then you can hold it.
So I'm curious, you mentioned office risk, and the only way to really do it right is buying it at incredibly low prices. How are you guys navigating that? I know that I'm working with both buyers and sellers right now within our portfolio and also on the brokerage side that are very, how do I put this right? That are very nervous about the prospect of either buying their office or selling it for incredibly low prices. And we haven't had a match or a meeting of the minds on a lot of these deals because I think the expectations are often so far off. What are you finding from your perspective?
You know, from my standpoint, historically, my belief has been, now this office has been a screwed up asset class. I've been in this business for 35 years. Office has been messed up for all 35 years. It's got a perpetual systemic problem of excess supply versus demand. And I'll call it the CEO problem, in that there's CEOs that build brand new buildings because they want this cool, sexy new building, even though there's plenty of space in town that they go occupy and fix up and make it nice. They want that new, sexy building. And I think that's a systemic problem that's never going away. And then you throw on top of it what happened with COVID and the work from home trend, you know, it took another swath of demand away. Now, I do think there's some recovery. People are realizing, I mean, look at the Amazon. Amazon's telling the employees they got to come back to the office. And so I do think there's something real about culture and education. The irony is the young professional is the one that typically wants the work from home option. But actually, it's usually the young professional that needs that same professional development and education and learning that they can get from fellow workers around them. And I do think that it's the youth that are getting hurt by the work from home movement. You know, guys like myself have been in the business for 35 years. I have my relationships. You know, I know the business well. I can operate really well remote. Now, even with that, you know, 2.5 years ago, I made all employees come back to the office saying, hey, that's not the company we're going to have. But so anyways, bottom line is there still hasn't been enough shift back to overcome the demand problem for office. And, you know, as these leases turn, you know, commercial leases range from 5 to 10 years generally. And so, you know, those leases are turning, and as they turn, you know, you're seeing people want to give back space. A lot of times they don't want to work through the rehab, so they move. So, you know, my viewpoint is there's tenants to be had in leasing. If you have a building that you fix up really nice with great amenities and you can give them a turnkey solution and they don't have to deal with a rehab inside and live through a rehab, if you're in a great location. So if you buy an asset for a good price and you have the capital to fix it up, there's tenants to be had right now, and tenants willing to move because they want something new. They want a new layout. They want a new strategy. They want some, you know, hotel type desks around for, you know, people that want to work remote. They want that flexibility. So I think there's demand to fill space, but So I would never buy anything but a reasonably vacant office building at a dirt cheap price in a great location. You really have to be a point with the equity guys that already lost their money, and you're dealing with the lender and it's a short sale. I don't see finding a bid-ask spread to solve the guy that bought that office building anytime before COVID and filling that gap. I think you're stuck going back. And what's going to really happen right now is most office market and most locations, especially I'll call non-class A second generation space, it's systemically going to be in that 60 to 70% occupancy range at best. And you're all going to be fighting for tenants. The TI turn costs are going to absolutely crush you. And so it's going to be nothing but negative cash flow. And the question is, give it up and give keys back? Do you have recourse debt? Do you have to worry about that? It's a permanent problem, in my opinion, and it's never going away. And it was never going away before COVID, and it just got, worse. But can you buy something for $30 a square foot, move tenants in, and get a fully leased building? And, you maybe demand a 10-year lease and go be in the building for maybe all in for 75 with all the turn costs and repositioning the building, and maybe sell for 100, 110. I think that's possible. But it takes the right location. It takes the right location because your cap rate's going to stink on the sale. You're not going to get a great cap rate on the sale. Now, if you have enough term, maybe. It's the formula is the office formula is completely broken. And you got a permanent systemic demand problem that I don't think goes away.
Where do you think the easiest fixes are to mend that office brokenness? Because I know from our end, what we see typically is entry point is one of the big challenges, and the buildings that we have that are green or profitable are all low entry point. But the biggest thing of all is TI dollars. I mean, it's really expensive to do an office deal today, at least in the Chicagoland area.
That's crazy.
Yeah. What are you seeing? Because what we're seeing is it could be $60 to $100 a foot.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
To get a deal done. And for most buildings, that just doesn't make sense unless you have a really high credit buyer. What are you seeing across the country in your portfolio?
Ultimately, it's going to be driven by the tenant's needs. I actually think it's kind of like a wounded duck situation, and it's the Walking Dead situation with office building owners. I don't know how, you get through it. I would say, we have a deal in Minneapolis. We just did 18,000 square foot tenant deal. Now we got that done for about $45-$50 a foot. We also got a 10-year lease out of it because, it's hard to make the math work if you don't get some term to go with it. We're not looking at much. It would have to be an absolute steal. And if it's an owner, I don't think you're ever going to bridge the bid-ask spread in general. So you're really stuck to where the lender's willing to take a short sale. Otherwise, I don't see the transaction happening.
Yeah. Our most successful office deals that we've done have generally been within either buildings that are debt-free before COVID that we were able to really go and invest money in and make right, or our buildings that we had distressed sales that we bought post COVID, and the entry point was just right to make things happen. So I'm curious, in terms of making things happen in distress, what are you seeing going forward into 2025? Where do you think some of the biggest opportunities will be in terms of deploying capital?
I still think of all the asset classes, I think the class B and A multifamily space outside of workforce housing is the best opportunity right now. Because you're going to be buying softer NOIs because, the general operations are soft right now. You also have a lot of community's getting really aggressive on the real estate tax side, and now you're able to go back and negotiate that. I would say we're also, when it comes to operating budgets, you know, we manage owner management for 45,000 units. We're starting to see actually possible reductions in bids, like service contractors, where there's enough softness operationally that the service providers are less busy. And so they're wanting to win business. So they're willing to reduce their prices a little bit to win that business. And, you know, I think when you start seeing the lack of deliveries starting to happen, and you're going to see vacancy start to rise, you're going to see concessions drift away, you're going to see occupancies rise. And once you have occupancy rise, concessions go away, you should be able to push rents. There's a stat I like to point to, and I think it's really important to go back to the year 2000, fast forward. In the last 24 years, compounded cost growth for new construction up 3.7% compounded over 24 years' time. That same time frame for multifamily rents, compounded rent growth only 3.2%. Even though we've had 70% rent growth the last 10 years, there was lots of periods where you didn't get rent growth because of things that were happening in the marketplace, which I could explain. But in general, the long-term compounded rent growth is only 3.2%. So rents have not kept up with the reality of what it costs to produce new product. And so there's a pretty big delta between existing inventory rents and what does it take to build new stuff. And as the market tightens up, I think it's going to be really interesting and where rents, how rents can continue to move, and that Class B, Class A tenant can afford to pay it, whereas the housing tenant cannot.
Can you explain kind of the delta between prices and rent growth, at least that you're seeing both in the past and now?
I percentage-wise, you know, across all the rental A, B, and C, you've seen similar percentage rent growth across the board there. But right now you're seeing really strong, really weak demand for workforce housing because, again, people, they move back home, they move in together, you know, they're getting evicted because they didn't pay their rent. So there's actually fewer renters out there with the ability to pay the rent on the workforce housing side. And then, you know, on the other stuff, I mean, you're really right now, rents are relatively flat right now. You know, you might be flat to 3% depending on location right now. But I think that snaps back once we absorb the excess deliveries in the last 24 months. So I'm looking out 3-4 years from now, and I think it's going to be a really interesting environment. Cause I do think we're going to get, materials, rents, snapback in operational income, higher vacancy, lower concessions, less delinquencies. And then once we have all that, I think you'll be able to push rents as well. And then I also think the institutional money is going to be fully back. And so the cap rates and demand for multifamily investment will be real. You know, bottom line is multifamily did its job in this cycle, and real estate as a whole did its job, industrial as well. Retail, actually, I kind of like retail, but that's a separate discussion. The value that multifamily held, we had this big inflation pop. Bonds took a direct mathematical hit because rates go up, bond prices go down. It's all very mathematical. But in multifamily or industrial too, we had the ability to push rents up. We had NOI growth that offset the effect of having higher cap rates. And so the inflation hedge that it provided was real. And it really did its job in the cycle. You know, that's one of the main reasons institutions and other investors should have, you know, real estate, private real estate in their portfolio because of that ability to move rents, you know, with inflation. You get that more in multifamily and industrial. Industrial has typically shorter lease terms. You know, industrial, you might have, you know, 3 to 5 year lease terms, even shorter. You know, multifamily is, you know, 12-month lease terms typically. And so the ability to move rents is real. So as costs are going up, you can push rents up and you can make up, you know, some of your value growth from higher cap rates through higher EBITDA, higher NOIs.
Why do you like retail? Because I look, there's a lot of folks out there that are very, very pessimistic and real doomers in the retail space. What do you see as the positive?
You know, it's a simple demand supply of inventory, right? So if for the last 14 years, you know, we've seen just incredibly low deliveries on new construction. You know, the lenders weren't lending. The math was tough. You know, hard to raise equity, you know, to build that stuff, the whole impact of, you know, what's the internet's impact going to be on retail? I mean, what every sense learned, in my viewpoint, is bricks and clicks matter. Most companies that have a bricks and clicks strategy are doing very well. And typically, just clicks or just bricks don't cut it. And you need bricks and clicks. No, there's a reason that Amazon bought Whole Foods. There's a reason. You know, they're also trying to solve that last mile delivery issue. But, you know, big picture, you have, I'll call it the demand side. There's demand side and supply side. And so on the supply side, limited supply growth. On the demand side, you have simple population growth, about 0.6% per year. And if you look at that 0.6% a year, that's probably about 2 million people a year that need to buy stuff. And there's 2 million more people in our society that need to buy stuff, ignoring all the stuff that's happening with immigration. They got to buy stuff. And more people buying stuff, retailers are healthy. Now, as an owner, the needs of retailers are changing and have been changing. And so there's a high cost as tenants move and their needs move. So there's a reality of the market changes and the way people are going to build their business or the way and type of retailers are out there. But the demand is there, but it's just that configuration and reconfiguration of space is going to happen. So it's going to be expensive. So we don't buy stabilized retail. I look to buy retail that's in a great location that's got vacancy that, again, I can pay a good price per square foot. And we're confident and believe, you know, we can fix this space, lease it up and improve the space, give it the cosmetic facelift that it needs and reposition a center and or solve the leasing problem through re-tenanting. Because we believe the demand's out there for space. It's just a question is, you know, what's the configuration, what's going to cost to get there? And again, there's the limited supply that's out there. These retailers need to go somewhere. And the demand side for product continues to grow because we got more and more people every year. So if you look at the math, we've been net absorption. Nationwide retail is 96% occupied. Forget about malls. You go back in the, you know, outside of malls, because all the power centers and strip centers, you know, you're about 96% occupied nationwide, which is nuts, right? And, you know, people are afraid of the asset class. But again, you continue to have limited deliveries. And it's very expensive. You know, the rents that you need for new construction are stupid high. And you compare that to what you bought, you know, the existing rents of existing centers is dramatically different. It's probably a 2x differential in rents between new construction versus existing product. So, and I think it's a decent asset class to own. But again, location matters a ton. You know, there's certain locations you just should not ever buy. Location, the whole ad is location, location, location is absolutely critical in retail. You know, industrial and multifamily get away with being on the fringes, but retail can't get away with being out the fringes.
Yeah. It's definitely got to be that little shop right around the corner or that last mile that's actually a mile.
The demographics matter a lot.
Yeah. In terms of that, I wanted to talk because we are getting to the end or the last mile of this podcast. And we always like to do something called the final four. It's a last little bit where we can really round up and learn a little bit more about you and learn a little bit more about the market. And so one of my favorite questions to ask is, where do you see real estate going 10 years from now?
Wow. 10 years from now, a lot can happen. So my biggest fear and as a real estate investor is government policy. Every time we've had a major problem in our industry from an investment perspective, it's always been caused by some government policy. I'll go way back to the Reagan years when they created the passive loss rules back in 1986. And I was at Pricewaterhouse at that time. They should have changed the rules prospectively, not retroactively, because all these real estate deals out there were done for income tax purposes. People are writing checks to fund the negative cash flow, but it made sense because of the income tax benefits they got. They were willing to write the check. As soon as the government took away all the tax benefits, they said, screw this, I'm not going to write the check for negative cash flow. And then this monster supply, and then it rippled back to the lending industry overall. And then you had the whole RTC days overall. You go back in 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. That Great Recession does not happen if we get back in the late 1990s, don't create policies that say, Gordon, you can buy four or five homes and you don't even have to have a job. If you got the down payment, we'll lend you the money. So the no doc, low doc period of time, when people could buy three, four, five homes, they didn't have the income to carry that, created excess false demand for single family. It actually pulled a ton of people out of multifamily into single family. So it created this real softness in multifamily. And that's part of the reason I went back before and I look at long-term multifamily rent growth. It was flat for the first 10 years of the century, from 2000 to 2010. Rents were relatively modestly flat. I mean, they went up a little bit, but it was really modest. And that's why it's important to go back to the year 2000 to look at rent growth. But so if I fast forward into the future, if the government just stays out of our way, the real estate industry is actually fairly disciplined in that when it starts getting soft, the lenders stop lending. The real estate guys don't want bad deals. Nobody wants a bad deal. Nobody ever wants to write checks, right? And so we do self-regulate to a degree. And, sometimes people go way too far off the edge on the fringes. But in general, the industry as a whole, it does regulate itself when things aren't going so good or it's real soft. Who wants to put up, an office building right now? The lenders wouldn't lend. And God forbid why you'd think it would work. Who would want to do that, right? So in the multifamily as well. I mean, there's been a lot of softness in multifamily, right? It's very hard to have the guts to go, spend $300,000 a unit to build a brand new product when the stuff that was built 4 years ago was built for $210 or $220. And you can buy it today for $210, $220 a unit on the street. And the new stuff costs $300 to produce. Pretty hard to take that in business risk to say, I'm going to get a high enough rent to justify that cost of putting it in the ground. So if the government stays out of the way, I think multifamily, industrial, retail are all great asset classes. I don't expect too much or hardly any office. It would have to be an extreme opportunity on the buy side. I think those asset classes are all in good shape. I mean, the balance, it's all about the balance of supply and demand. And there's a lot of momentum to repatriate jobs back to the United States. There's a big push to move jobs back to the States. It's great for industrial. It's also good for office. But, there's certainly we've got a policy to grow up populations for immigration as well. That's going to create demand for retail. That's a great demand for multifamily. So I think that, multifamily, industrial, retail all look really healthy to me over the next 10 years. I think it's going to be a great time to be an investor in that space. I think the inflation bumps that we have, the costs, they're permanent. Costs aren't going back down.
Yeah, so costs aren't going back down, that's for sure. One of the things that's not going back, though, as well, is time. And we like to jump and talk about how we start off in the industry, because there's a lot of listeners on the podcast, at least, a large cadre of them that are younger, at least under 35. Many of them are transitioning out of other professions or just starting off in their real estate career. And I'm curious, if you could step back in time and give some advice, what would it be?
I would say as a young person starting out in the business, you should definitely go identify the guys that are doing it right. They have success. Go work there. Go learn. And, frankly, don't be afraid to stay there, because if you're talented, most real estate guys understand the need to include talent in the promote structures, the profit sharing. And we give 65% of all of our promotes and profit sharing out to the team. I own 100% of the company, but I share 65% of all the promotes and profits, annual operating profits as well with the team. Not every shop does that. Not every shop has good succession plans. But I would say go identify good firms, go work for them, learn from guys that know what they're doing, that are successful, and then you can make the call. Do you want to stay there? Do they have a fair environment for me? But once you learn the business, your skills are transportable to go off on your own, whether it be in raising your own capital, set up your own shop if you want, or if you got a great company that's got a great structure for you, stay. So, you know, that I would focus on that. I wouldn't be too quick to go off on your own too quickly because you don't know what you don't know. You know, I will say if I know all the things I know, there's a lot of mistakes I could have avoided in my career. And as good as we are and as good as that we've done and as good as we've been blessed, you know, we made a lot of mistakes, you know, over the last 35 years. You know, why not learn from my mistakes? I mean, all the mistakes I've made, I share with my team and educate them, train them, teach them, pour into them. Go grab that. Go find a company and grab that knowledge and that wisdom and don't go through the pain yourself. Because why? You know, why not learn from somebody else's pain and then take the pain yourself?
So one of the ways we try to avoid taking the pain ourselves is going and learning from somebody else via books. And I'm a voracious reader, at the very least via audio tape, and then very much occasionally on a late night or a Saturday or a Sunday, the traditional book. And so I'm curious if you could recommend one book for our listeners.
You know, I'm going to go off script for you a little bit because I'm a big believer in organizational structure. And having an organization that's got the right corporate governance, corporate structure. A lot of companies, they go away because they don't do good succession planning. They don't do things that retain talent. So I would recommend a book called Mission Drift. It's by Peter Greer. And it's actually really more for the context of nonprofits. And it's like, how do you avoid mission drift? And you think about a lot of our Ivy schools at one time, they had strong beliefs in free speech, strong beliefs in faith and all these different things. And today it's like, if you don't believe what one segment of the group believes, you're like ostracized. The concept of free speech is out the door. So you had great organizations that have really drifted from their original mission. And I even think inside of our company. So, you know, having a structure and a board structure and a strategy that emphasizes how do you maintain culture? How do you maintain talent and a culture that pours into people and has empathy for their fellow employees and wants to work as a team and serve one another? How do you maintain those cultures? And one of the biggest messages of the book is when you have like board structures, forget board limits. You want people that indefinitely committed to you until you either want them off or they want to retire. So, because there's no reason to push talent out the door. And commonly, in whether it be nonprofits or whatever, they have board limits. After 4 or 5 years, you're done. And people are afraid of that long-term commitment. So they don't want to sign up for it. But I'm a big believer in having no board limits. So we set up our succession planning here. We have a board structure that's meant to keep the operating folks in, you know, in balance and check and whatever. But the idea is they're well-educated on our strategies. They're well-educated on our industry and our core talent, how to keep our core talent. Why would you want them to leave? And so how do you structure the organization to be multi-generational in nature? I've worked very hard to do that here. And so that's why I'd recommend reading the book.
That's phenomenal. How do you apply it in your business? How do you apply the reduction of mission drift? You've been working there for a long time. How do you implement it in practice?
So in our company, what we've done is the guys that run the company, to truly run the company, and I have zero day-to-day responsibilities anymore. I get to come to work and do what I want to do and work on the things that create value for the organization. But somebody here does everything, and I get to come and just be a coach and focus on that. But so the operating guys are really the board of the company, and they run the company. Okay. and they have authority to do stuff. And they even have the authority. I'm talking about that 65% promote share. They get, they allocate that out to the team and who they think earns it and deserves it. Now we have some caps, so no person gets over certain amounts. Therefore, it forces allocation of the promote structure deep into the organization, and sharing that wealth and opportunity among the organization. But then we have a independent voting trustee structure, which are not employees, which are independent people. In general, it's meant to be ex-MLGers that understand our business and our industry, but a sprinkle in a few independents. And their job is to keep the board accountable to long-term things like talent retention. What are you doing to retain your talent? What are you doing to keep them on board and saying, I want to be here for the next 30 years, when the trend is go learn and jump to the next company, right? And so are you creating an environment that's going to keep and retain your talent? Are you maintaining the disciplines on the buy side? You know, Gordon, I know you do some investing, and you know, the buy side discipline is critical. You know, so are you maintaining that buy side discipline in the process of how you're adding assets? In the case, we have our closed end funds and we have our evergreen fund, but you know, how do you maintain buy side discipline? Is the team truly doing that? And are they being strategic about what the focus is? And are they maintaining all the research? Are they doing all the research to understand what's happening in our industry? And are they staying abreast of the things that they need to be educated on? So it's that accountability to the executive team. Are they doing those things? And a lot of it's about talent retention, because if you don't maintain your talent, what organization do you have? And I'd say most companies, they try to give the company to their kids or to their buddy. And the reality is that next gen may not have the talent to have the respect of the talent that's there. And then all the talent departs, and then that company goes away. And if you look at most real estate companies, they come and go as the next generation doesn't have the ability to run it.
So we've got to get to the next question. I know talking about the next generation, we could do a whole separate podcast on that. This is a constant issue that plagues the commercial real estate industry. But the next question that we have is the whole reason for the podcast. It's why we have so many listeners, and it's folks that want to go and reach out to interesting voices in the industry. And we find that the men and women in the arena, they are the ones that tend to have the voice that we should be listening to. And who should that next person be on the podcast?
Next person on the podcast. You know, there's so many talented people out there in the industry. You know, I would actually focus on two groups. I'd say, who is my developers? Because a lot of guys want to be in the development space. And what is that development world looking like? Jim Schlamer from Continental Properties here based in Wisconsin, long-term real estate guy, understands the space well. On the investment side, you know, I would say even somebody like from NML, Northwestern Mutual, you know, they have this strong investment group, long history of great performance on the investment side. They might be an interesting group to talk to as well. And some of the leadership there on the real estate side.
Look, I'd love to reach out, but there's one last thing before we let you go. And it's, if somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
I'm at mlgcapital.com. Mary, Larry, Gary, mlgcapital.com. You certainly get there. You know, it's twallen@mlgcapital.com. And more than happy to chat. And I appreciate the time here today, Gordon.
Tim, thank you so much. And we have to have you on in the future.
Thanks again to Tim. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, subscriptions, and interactions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.